Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Luke O'Neill. Thank you for downloading, subscribing and rating. Coming up on this week's show, what determines the birth sex of a child and the role of mitochondria in why we need sleep. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, @NewstalkScience. And as ever, we get to all of your comments at the end of the show. First up, as always, it's time to look back at some of the breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman of Research Ireland and Dr. Susan Kelleher of DCU. You're both very welcome. And our first story has to do with magic mushrooms. Now, Ruth, this sounds very interesting indeed. As someone who's never had them, I imagine. But what's the story with magic mushrooms this week?
I mean, when you say magic mushrooms, we all think about psychedelics. But actually, in recent years, there's been a fair number of clinical trials looking at the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, which is called psilocybin, and studying it for mental health conditions like depression, anxiety and PTSD. So there's like hundreds of studies going on. But this particular new study, which has been done by Baylor College of Medicine and Emory University in the US, is looking at this idea of the psilocybin telomere hypothesis. So what is that, you might say? So one of the things that we know is that chronic stress can increase our cellular aging for lots of different reasons. And one of the things that happens in our cells when we age is that our telomeres get shorter. And you can think about telomeres, they're a bit like the thing on the end of your shoelace to protect your DNA, and they get a bit shorter as we age. So the question is, if our mental health was improved by taking something like psilocybin, might that also protect the length of our telomeres? So that's what this group looked at. So they went into the lab first and they looked at cells. They looked at human lung and skin cells and they treated them with psilocin, which is what psilocybin gets metabolized to in our body. And what they found, and they were pretty staggered by this, was that the cells lived up to 57% longer than untreated cells, which is pretty incredible. And what they found was there was less reactive oxygen species. So these are the kind of free radicals that we can get in cells that might damage our DNA. So you might say, well, that's fine, but it's just in cells. So they went a bit further and they went in vivo, not into humans, yep, but into mice. So they had mice, female mice, that were about 18 months old, which is about the equivalent of age 60 for a human. And they were given monthly doses of psilocybin over 10 months. And what they found was that the mice who had received the psilocybin, after 10 months, 80% of them were still alive compared to only 50% of the control group. So that was pretty interesting. But even further than that, they found that they actually seemed to be better. So they had, where they had gone a bit bald, the hair grew back. Where they had started to go a little bit white around the whiskers, they went brown again. And they couldn't really detect any sort of uncontrolled growth, right, like cancer, because that might have been an issue as well. So this is really, really interesting research. Yeah. And it's all about, I suppose, good aging as opposed to maybe just longevity and being around for longer.
It does seem remarkable, the data, doesn't it?
It does seem
remarkable.
And
I looked at the paper myself, actually, and there are significant effects here. It's not as if it's a small effect either. There's something going on here, basically. It looks impressive, doesn't it?
There is. And I mean, I think that's where a lot of scientists will look at this and go, it looks so radical almost that you'd like to see it repeated for sure. And look, it's in mice. The doses that they gave the mice were considerably higher than what we've looked at in human trials for depression.
Right.
Now, obviously, mice have a different kind of metabolism to humans, but I think this is really exciting, but it's definitely early research and we wouldn't want to all rush out and start taking illegal psilocybin
at this
point.
But are the mice going on a trip? I mean, the psychoactive part of this will still be active, I presume, will it?
I presume it will. So, I mean, they didn't talk about that in the paper, but the fact that they're giving quite high doses. Now, I think for the human studies where you're looking at using psilocybin for depression or mental health, a lot of those would be very small doses, which I think would be lower than those that would kind of cause the psychedelic effects.
Right.
But I mean, aging is a big problem. I mean, in the US, average lifespan has started to go down. This is an area of real interest. And, you know, trying to understand at a cellular level what's happening here, you know, it seems to be there's transcription factors being turned on and off. You know, we're looking at damage to DNA that's being prevented. So it's definitely something that I'm sure there's going to be a huge amount more research on.
Right. One last thing on this. I mean, there's an awful lot of rubbish about anti-aging, isn't there, Ruth, as well? Quack,
I mean,
stuff and awful nonsense.
Well,
huge market.
Talk about creams and, you know, the latest superfood and things. This possibly has a little bit more substance than many of those. So we'll keep an eye on it.
Keep an eye on it. Very good. Thank you very much for that one. Now, Susan, as a chemist, you've picked plastics, good plastics, or shall we say, or another way to replace plastics.
Yes, an alternative. I mean, we often hear of these super materials or alternatives to plastics, but this certainly seems very impressive, largely because it's quite scalable and it's a one-pot synthesis. But it's around work that's been done and published in Nature Communications by researchers in Rice University and the University of Houston. And they developed a new form of a material from bacterial cellulose. So it's a new type of cellulose. And now, the cellulose is the type of fibre that comes from bacteria and that they naturally produce it when they're forming, say, biofilms. But this team didn't grow it in its usual way. They designed a rotating bioreactor, which looks as cool as it sounds.
Have you got a picture? It sounds fantastic.
There is in the paper, indeed. And it is sort of like a spinning liquid chamber that gently nudges the fibres into perfect alignment as they're being formed. And usually bacterial cellulose forms a sort of like a web, which is strong but not particularly useful. But the spinning method they used aligns these cellulose nanofibers into sheets that are extremely strong. The basic aligned sheet that they made hit around 430 megapascals in tensile strength, stronger than aluminium. And then when they reinforced it with what's called boron nitride, sort of like small sheets of nano material, the material reached 553 megapascals, which is as strong as steel. And the key here is the thickness of the fibres that they've made. They're only about 20 nanometers wide, but when they stack together, the sheet is around as thick as a piece of paper, so 100 microns. So in about a centimetre squared area, you have around 2.5 billion nanofibres in there, all aligned the same way and structurally making the whole thing a lot more stable and a lot stiffer. Yeah. What's really interesting as well is that it's foldable, it's transparent, and it's stable under repeated bending. So there's a lot of applications, say, where metals like steel and aluminium equivalents just would fall short. And then also when they reinforced it with the boron nitride, what they found was that the material also dissipated heat three times more than the non-reinforced material. So for electronics or for energy applications, there's could be a super light, flexible material that could be used in, you know, in those types of settings.
Right.
And like I said, it's scalable. It seems to be really, you know, that's a big thing, right? We can always make a new material in the lab, but can you scale it? Can you do it in a simple process? So this doesn't use any petrochemical solvents. It doesn't use any post-processing. It just forms it in situ and collects it and gathers it into these really strong
sheets. I've got a killer question. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Is it biodegradable?
I presume it is.
Even though it's this very dense net mesh, shall we say. You know the idea, you discover something that doesn't quite work out in the way you want.
Yes.
But it is biodegradable, isn't it?
It is biodegradable because it's cellulose and it's formed from bacteria. So,
right.
And bacteria are a relatively cheap way of making things in a large quantity, as we know.
The trick was to get the bacteria to weave the stuff in a way. Whether by sticking it in these rotational bioreactors, indeed, and now they weave out the cellulose
to gather it. Really, it's a bit of engineering as well as the biology. That's both of those teamed together, which speaks to the strength of multidisciplinary work.
Exactly, and the megapascal thing, that's simply to do with the mesh or whatever, is it?
Exactly.
There's no chemical thing
there's
here
no
necessarily.
Chemical. It's just them very closely, those nanofibers getting so closely held together that they're able to produce an increased force at that level, at that nanoscale,
it's a great news story in a way, isn't it? Here's a way potentially to replace plastics
if
this continues.
Let's keep an eye on this too, because we know we need a solution, and there's lots of options on the table, but this certainly looks like something that could be very positive.
And it won't generate microplastics, which is the big fear about
plastic,
that spits out these microplastics, which have all kinds of harmful effects.
You can break it down to a certain amount, but if you don't keep breaking it down, then you're stuck halfway broken down.
Yep. Now, Ruth, another good news, well, the kind of good news story is optimists.
Well, it depends where you're coming from.
It's
a good news
story. But this is another fascinating one. I love the ones you've picked, by the way, both of you. So this one is all about optimists and what's happening in their brains, right?
Well, optimists and pessimists. So you might imagine if we, the three of us, we were in the middle of a group of 100 people and we were all asked to think about a future event and we all imagined that in our own brains, in our own way, that would be completely unique to all of us. But in fact, that's not quite true. And that's what this study is telling us. What actually is seems to be going on, that if in that group 100 people, half of them were optimists, the pattern that we might see in their brains might all be quite similar. But for all those that had quite a pessimistic view of what might be upcoming, they would have all a very different pattern in their brain. So how did researchers look into this? This comes from Kobe University in Japan, and it was published in the Proceedings of the National Academies of Sciences in the USA. And what they did was they got a group of participants and they put them all in a brain scanner, in an fMRI scanner, and they asked them to imagine positive, neutral or negative future events involving them or their spouse. And then afterwards, they completed a detailed standard questionnaire, which captures, you know, whether you lean on the optimistic or pessimistic scan. And then they looked into a part of their brain, which is the medial prefrontal cortex. And that's part of the brain that's involved in future thinking and also in social cognition, how we understand what's going on with people around us. And what they found was that those people who had an optimistic perspective shared highly similar patterns of brain activity, while those who had much more pessimistic outlooks had these unique patterns. And the other thing about the optimists is they were able, their brain patterns of activity were much more distinct when they thought about positive things versus negative things. So it was like there was a clearer separation in their brain of different types of future events. And in fact, when they repeated it again with a totally different group of people, so they had 37 in the first group, then they had 50 in the second group, they found pretty consistent results. So, I mean, I think people who've commented on the paper have said this is the Anna Karenina principle. This is this idea from the Tolstoy book, all happy families are alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Yeah.
That's a brilliant quote, isn't it? That explains what's in the paper entirely, doesn't it?
It is. And it's this idea that, I mean, people often say that the principle here is there's kind of only one way things can go right, but there's many, many ways things can go wrong. But really what neuroscientists and behavioural psychologists are linking this to is this idea that maybe optimists also are more likely to end up in the centre of social groups because they do in fact think about things the same way perhaps. And this idea that you're on the same wavelength as someone or you just click with someone straight away, you know, maybe there's some neurological and biological substance to that. So it's really fascinating.
Well, you've said something that explains the paper to me because I had a look at it as well. I mean, it could be the case that if we're all optimists, we're all on the one wavelength, shall we say. If you're a pessimist, many different things can happen.
Yeah.
So your brain has to be a bit more plastic or whatever to sense possibilities such that you survive, I suppose.
Yeah, and a fascinating idea is, you know, if you do something like cognitive behavioral therapy and you sort of train your brain to try and focus on more positive outcomes, you know, would this pattern change over time in your brain? So, you know, as with all research, it opens up even more fascinating questions to look into.
Well, in the discussion, they talk of the usual, is it genetic or environmental? If you're a pessimist or an optimist, that's both as usual, I imagine. But is that a possibility that we can train people's brains?
Well, I think we can. I mean, we know that things like cognitive behavioural therapy works. We know things like exercise work. And, you know, even back to the psilocybin, we know like there's serotonin receptors in every cell in our body. So, you know, our brains and our bodies don't operate distinctly and our brains are a combination.
Right.
Of our thoughts, but also the physiological, chemical things that are going on. So, maybe we could.
But scientifically, I was worried slightly about these studies in a way. And I know it's in the eminent National Academy of Sciences, so obviously it's been well refereed. It's only 87 people. And how do you determine if someone's an optimist or a pessimist? That's based on a questionnaire, isn't it? And that can make it a bit more loose scientifically. I'm not against it, by the way. It's great this work is being done, but I always have a slight question about some of these kinds of studies.
When we look back over behavioural science research and things that sort of tried to assign fixed personality types to people, I think a lot of it has fallen away under really tough scrutiny. But I think as we use things like AI, we're going to get much bigger data sets as we're able to monitor people's physiological reactions to their life in real time with wearables and things like that. You can imagine this field is going to get a lot more data heavy over time. So, you know, I think it's interesting, but I think it's also interesting to think about how we work together as social groups and how we can prevent people from being excluded and how we can set up society so that it doesn't just work for one type of person.
Because
none of us wants that.
It's a striking finding, isn't it? And what I like about it is that social psychologists working with neuroscientists together.
Well, again, interdisciplinary research.
And that's the key to the breakthrough, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Very nice. Now, Susan, our last one is about dinosaurs.
Well, this is interesting because I think, you know, I have young children and we're watching, you know, scary things with dinosaurs in them and dinosaurs are, you know, big thing in the house. And when we think about dinosaurs, we think about the sound that a dinosaur makes, and it's this roar, right?
Obviously.
And obviously, I mean, that's the reason we...
I've seen Jurassic Park. They definitely roar, right?
Yeah. Definitely a roar. But maybe the question here with this new paper is it? This paper came from a journal called PeerJ, and they've looked at a new fossil that's been discovered in China. And it's not on... This is the second of such fossils, but this fossil shows that this new dinosaur called the Pularosaurus basically has the type of vocal cords that a bird would have. And we know from a lot of studies that birds have evolved from dinosaurs, but in fact, these types of dinosaurs are not connected to the birds' the stream in evolution. So it's really interesting that they have these vocal cords, but they've... basically sort of turned this idea of these specific type of dinosaurs and how they sound on their head. They are small dinosaurs, only about 70 centimetres long, and they say that the way that the there's basically cartilage deep down in the vocal cords that suggests that they maybe whistled or honked a little bit more like a goose than or a robin than a raptor. So while there's loads of, you know, predictions and guessing about dinosaurs, I mean, we didn't see them, so we have to try and extrapolate a lot of information from what we find. There's, you know, I think an idea that we turn on our heads, this concept of what a dinosaur might actually sound like, and maybe this could have been an adorable house pet in a different land, you know, cat-sized, feathered, chirping, so you know,
it's a bit idea. It's disappointing to think that all these dinosaurs weren't honking at each other like geese. It seems to make less adventurous.
More wonderful, Luke.
Well, it could be wonderful as well.
It could be wonderful, you know, maybe it's all type of dinosaur, every kind of sound and size.
But it's incredible that birds are descended from dinosaurs. I mean, people who listen to Future Proof would know that.
I know.
But those who don't know that, when we see birds flying around, they're actually descended from dinosaurs.
They are the closest living relatives.
They're living,
you know,
they're
living dinosaurs, as they say. And I think I learned that in undergrad in evolutionary biology, and never left me that idea that, you know, there's a closely, you know, there's a dinosaur, the dinosaurs are among us.
And this adds weight to that notion, presumably, that these dinosaurs may have been tweeting away or whatever the word
Absolutely.
Is, as
and
opposed
even though
to
they're
roaring
not in the same
at
evolutionary strand, you know, the fact that there's a co-evolution here as well of a, you know, obviously vocal, purposeful, you know, they weren't just hissing or making sounds, they were actually actively controlling their vocal cords in order to communicate. So fascinating stuff.
Yeah. I read somewhere as well, and Ruth might chip in, this is the evolution of this business, right? So they reckon it took 80 million years of time for a dinosaur to turn into a bird, if you know what I mean. It just seems amazing. Another one I love is to turn a mouse into an elephant. Guess how long that would take, Ruth, in evolutionary time?
100 million years.
Close enough. 80 million
80
years.
Well, okay.
Now, what that tells me is how complicated evolution is, in a sense.
Yeah. Well, all
you need is time.
The magic ingredient of evolution.
And variation. It builds up and builds up over time, I suppose.
That's someone has to now get the Jurassic Park visuals and put birds tweeting over the most dramatic scenes. We have to see that.
Yeah, well, I love that. The headline, Susan, was the dinosaur probably tweeted instead of roared.
Indeed.
It didn't mean to be sending messages on X necessarily.
No, I did check. I went into detail to make sure they... It wasn't the social media.
Only some dinosaur
communication. Yes.
Very important. Well, thank you both very much. Thank you, Ruth and Susan, for joining me today. And will I reveal that I lectured the pair of you all those years ago?
Go on.
I taught Susan and Ruth everything then. No, they did science in Trinity.
The grounding.
What year was it, Susan? Do you want to reveal?
I graduated 2005.
2005, that was 2001. Ruth, it was probably 90 something. No.
No, I'm going to say 96, but I'm really bad on years.
There you have it. It's wonderful to see my few lectures didn't destroy your interest in science.
No good maths, really.
No.
There was a
risk of it. Absolutely fascinating. And I did a degree in medicinal chemistry started in 96, I suspect. Unless you.
96.
Otherwise, you're aging. Maybe you're taking some.
Ruth is on psilocybin. Thank you both very much indeed. Welcome back to Future Proof with me, Luke O'Neill. Now, have you ever wondered why some families seem to have only boys or only girls? Is it just the look of the draw, like a coin toss, or is there more to this whole story? Now, today, we're joined by Su Wen Wang, a PhD student in nutritional epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, whose research has been diving into the science behind this. And Su Wen has come across something very fascinating. It isn't just random. You're very welcome to the show, Su Wen.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me and your interest in our research.
Not at all. Now, can I ask you, first of all, what's it like in Harvard these days? We hear all kinds of things about Harvard here in Europe. Are you experiencing any negativity?
So I think it's not surprising for people who are watching the news and kind of like having some interest in science, there are some very direct funding cuts that's in Harvard and in Harvard School of Public Health specifically. It is fortunate that some of the research funding are preserved, but I would say the majority of the funding are very heavily impacted, and definitely a lot of people are affected, and some important research about health are halted and paused for the moment.
Right, but let's hope it comes back. I've got collaborators in Harvard as well, so I'm well aware. I'm an immunologist, you see, and I'm well aware of what's going on over there. But we'll move on a more positive note, shall we, to your discovery. Now, you've analysed over 58,000 US women with regard to whether they have boys or girls. And what was the key thing you found?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what we found with the samples that we have, which are the 58,000 US women who have more than 146,000 births from the two national cohorts. And the first thing we found was that the offspring sex does not necessarily follow a simple random coin toss model as we normally think. Instead, it fits better a beta binomial model, meaning that each family may have their own unique weighted coin that is biasing towards having a boy or a girl.
Right.
And from there, we went a little bit further to investigate whether there are some potential maternal factors that are associated with having only boys or only girls. And what we found was that, first of all, older maternal age at first birth was associated with a slight increased chance of having same-sex offspring. And for the genetic analysis that we've done, we found that some common maternal genetic variants, one of them is associated with having only boys and another one associated with only girls.
Right. And that was unexpected to some extent, I guess. But you might explain to our listeners, just in case they don't know, what determines the sex. They might be surprised to hear that there can be male and female sperm effectively, right?
Mm-hmm. So it is very interesting to see the findings coming out. And as you mentioned, it is quite surprising to us that we are able to identify some maternal factors that might affect offspring sex. But I do want to caution the interpretation is that it is not like for a prediction at the individual maternal level, or it is not for intervention or anything, nor do we do any like biological experiment with the mom or the dad to see whether there is any specific mechanism associated with that. At this point, everything is just population trends, and we're excited to see more research coming in the field.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's a population-based study rather than individuals, I guess, is the key thing, isn't it, to draw from it? But
yeah,
there was
quite critical.
A couple of headlines that struck me. For women, and you kind of said it, but women over 28, the older women, had higher odds of having, say, only sons, right? Whereas it was a 61% chance of another boy if a woman had three boys, for instance. You began to uncover some unusual associations here, didn't you? But do you think overall then for older women, there's a higher chance that they will have, say, sons and not have, say, a son and a daughter or a daughter and a son, say. Is that one thing you're getting from the study?
So I think it's partially correct. So what we actually found was that older maternal age at first birth, for example, those who had their first birth greater than age 28 compared to those younger than 23, they are not only at higher risk of having only boys, but only higher risk of having only girls as well. So like overall higher risk of having same-sex family.
Right.
It is not just boys or girls. And it is around 10% higher risk. And for the 61%, that is like, as you mentioned, for those who on average have three boys already, would probably the next, the sex of the next child would be more likely to be boy.
But
again, these numbers are quite like subtle difference from 50%. I think what is meaningful at this point is that we are able to characterize some statistical significant shifts, although they're very small, but it points to some research direction on the sex determination, maybe focusing not only the dad, but also the mom.
Right.
But also, as I highlighted over and over again, these are subtle changes. It's not like you're going to the 100-0 or 80-20 kind of chance. So definitely don't really attribute the offspring sex to any of the single maternal factors.
Right, but there's still a statistical aspect to this as well. You might be able to say, if you've had three boys, there's a good chance the fourth is going to be a boy. Because many parents think, don't they, let's say they have two boys, they will go again in the hope of having a girl, right? But your research is kind of saying you're more likely to have a boy now, because you can't have a girl. It's purely statistical and odds, isn't it, really? But that seems to me to be something that the lay audience might take from this. But the other thing to say, Suwin, is that the mechanism. Now, I'm a biochemist as well, and what's going on here? And you've identified two genes, right? Or variants in genes that could be part of this. So tell us about those genes.
Yeah, so one gene, one SNP that we identify is near the gene NSUN6. The other one is TSHSET1. So as of now, neither of these two genes have been previously reported to be associated or critical in sex determination process per se. But it is possible that some genetic functions are still under exploration. And it is also possible that what we found would need further replication across different populations and different studies. So the specific function about these two genetic variants, one is in RNA modification, the other one is facial development. So right now, they're not specifically tied to sex determination, but like I just mentioned, it is very hard to come across a very strong biological mechanism at this stage, and we didn't do any biological experiment at this stage as well. So right now, it's just really very preliminary results. We would likely to call it a first draft of research into this maternal genetic association with offspring sex. And we definitely welcome more research coming in with greater population variety and different techniques.
I get that, but it's still exciting. I think, well done. You've got two possible, now obviously, as you say, the work needs to be extended, but there's two genes here now, variants in genes that might predict having a daughter. And as you said, it was unusual because one's tied into tRNA, isn't it, and protein production. The other one's tied into olfaction and craniofacial development. That's an unusual thing to think about, I guess. They wouldn't be directly involved. But still, I presume these two genes, others will now jump on them, shall we say, and begin looking at them. And of course, there could be other genes as well, I would imagine. Have you any other candidate genes in mind? Or were they the main two that stood out?
We did not really come up with very strong hypothesis about anything. It is really what the data told us, and these genes kind of just passed the threshold that we have for what we call a genetics significance signal, and then we kind of just got very surprised by it as well.
Sure, it's something else. I read your paper, and I didn't realize this either, so this is slightly different. I guess it's more of the background. So it said vaginal pH can have a role. Is that right? So in other words, as you age, as the woman ages, there's a decrease in pH, and sperm with the X chromosome might survive better. Is that right? That struck me as a fascinating idea. In other words, this type of sperm is being selected in a way to be, say, a female sperm, and then you're going to get a female, or a Y chromosome if the pH is higher. That's another strange aspect of this, isn't it? I guess that has been worked on before, I presume.
Thank you for bringing that up. I think we do come up with different possible mechanisms or explanations for why we found maternal factors might affect offspring sex. And as we mentioned in the study limitation, one possible explanation is that older maternal age is a proxy for older paternal age, but unfortunately, we just don't know paternal age or paternal genetic, paternal biological factors. But other things that we hypothesized, definitely one included vaginal pH, the other is menstrual cycle characteristics or menstrual cycle phase during which conception happened. But the studies we cited did look into those specific maternal factors affecting X or Y chromosome survival and viability. These are all fascinating to me, honestly, and the evidence about these things are also very scarce and still in development, and definitely would I would be very, very excited to see new research, new evidence come into this field.
Well, now the thing is, it fascinates people, doesn't it? Anybody who wants to have kids are thinking, is it a boy? Is it a girl? Can they influence that in various ways? And there's all kinds of sort of, legends and myths around this, isn't there? And people trying to do certain things to increase the chance of a boy or a girl. But a lot of that will be nonsense, if I can use that word.
I would say, based on our study finding, we did not try to claim that anything is like a causal factor for any of the sex of each birth or sex clustering within families. Rather, as I mentioned, those are population level trends. And there are a lot of things that we still don't know, such as biological, behavioral, or paternal side of things that really need to be kind of clearly accounted for. And for those population level trends, it is really hard to intervene or predict or anything. One example that I usually like to make is the fact that smoking is usually associated with much higher risk of lung cancer, but not everyone who smoke get lung cancer, or not everyone have lung cancer smoke. So this is kind of the same idea for the research that we're doing. None of these things, even found to be associated with a higher population level risk, does not really explain anything that you're seeing for your specific birth.
Gotcha.
So just don't overthink about that. Focus on having a healthy baby.
Well, it tells us it's just very complicated, isn't it, really? It's not, you can't be deterministic about it. But what strikes me is you've come across something that's really fascinating. And what's next then? What happens next? I presume you're going to extend this in various ways or inspire other scientists to continue looking at this.
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest takeaway that we have from this study is that definitely the way to think about sex determination is probably not as simple or as straightforward as we thought it might be as a 50-50 event. There are a lot of previous study have already looked into this, and more study is definitely needed. And one specific thing that we're interested in doing is because our study have very, very rich complete nutritional data. Like, we ask about their diet every 4 years. We ask them to complete 150-ish items on reporting the frequency, the amount that they eat. So we're able to characterize, like, for example, the diet prior to their pregnancy and their association with the sex clustering, for example. So that's one possible direction we might go. And in the future, if we do have data about father, definitely we can look into how maternal and paternal factor act jointly, act independently to affect the sex clustering.
Gotcha. Well, Sivan, thanks very much for joining us. And thank you for describing this really fascinating study. And I wish you all the best with your PhD. When are you going to have your PhD, do you think? Are you close to it?
I think it's expected to be finished by 2027.
Right. Oh, you've got a bit more time to go then to do more research. Fantastic to add to this study.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And all the very best. That was Su-Wen Wang, a PhD student in Harvard, telling us all about whether you have a boy or a girl. It's not 50-50. Certain things will determine the chance that you might have a boy or a girl. Now, some of your texts and comments from last week in the biobank has generated a fair bit of interest. Surely the data the biobank team gathers about an individual, the person has a right to know their health results, even if it is not serious. That's from Joe. It's a good question, Joe. I know a lot about the biobank myself, actually. And I guess it's being examined now what rights people will have. There's a million people involved here. But surely some information will have to go back to the people. And I think that's probably being examined. The second comment is with the biobank, would there be any risk of a leak of this personal health data? And the answer is no. They're very particular about that, as you can imagine. And people have given their samples and their information have been assured full privacy. So there's no concerns on that one. That's it for this episode. Thanks to Mairéad O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin and Hugo De Silva on sound. And thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.